not willing, it says I shouldn't even eat. Bottom line, a lazy person is not placing himself or herself in a position of greatness. That revelation sealed a deal for me. I knew from that day forward, my pay scale was not in the hands of man. If God was pleased with my work performance, then no one, not even a devil in hell, could prevent me from getting what God planned for me. You gotta place yourself in miracle territory. Now, it's difficult to convince young people about the value of work, right? So when I'm trying to help young people make that connection, when I'm trying to convince them of just how invaluable work is, I often compare it to flying first class. All right, so if you've never flown first class before, you might be under the impression that it's just hype. But let me assure you, it's more than hype. All right, you might be saying to yourself, there is really not a big difference between coach and, let's say, business class and first class, except the price tag. Let me tell you something. I've flown first class. It's a huge difference, all right? And I've flown coach on an international flight, and I've flown in first class. Let me tell you something, guys. I will not go coach again. I prefer the first class experience. Besides the obvious, more leg room, wider seats, hot meals, convenient access to the restroom, electrical access, real glasses, a hot wash rag, I think you get the point. The potential networking opportunities are astronomical. All right. So I discovered the same thing is true when you are passionate about your work and about the process. All right. Now, listen to me. There are a lot of people when it comes to work, like they're average, right? They're not even good. Most people are average, mediocre. And so they're getting a coach experience at their job, but they're expecting a first class experience, right? So the effort they're given is average, but they're expecting a first class experience. And so listen to me very closely. When you're passionate about your work and about the process, it's like flying first class. You automatically put yourself in miracle territory. It's not about liking or disliking the company that you are employed by. No, that's not what it's about. It's not about the relationship between you and your supervisor or colleagues for that matter. It's about taking advantage of the opportunity that has been given. It's about working at your optimal level. And if you're not giving, listen to me, if you're not willing to give 120%, then don't get upset when those around you are getting promotions and raises and other benefits. Look, you have to realize you can't expect a full harvest when you are not willing to put forth your best effort. Because I understood that concept, I walked into the Olive Garden like I owned shares in the company. I was not a cook. I was too young to wait tables. The law in Alabama stated that you had to be at least 21 to sell liquor. But that didn't stop the kid. That didn't stop me from learning the entire menu and what each dish contained. I studied everything. I could tell you what was in the salad and both soups. I could even break down the meat and the vegetable dishes. There was a huge vegetarian population in Huntsville, and I wanted to make sure, absolutely, listen to me, sure, their experience was unforgettable. I worked hard, and because of that, doors began opening up for me. For instance, regular customers, they used to come in all the time and request that I serve their tables. Even though I wasn't a waiter, I read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And in his book, I learned that it was important to remember every customer's name and try to remember their order. Every single time they visited the restaurant, I called them by name and remembered what they generally ordered. And they felt, man, they felt like they were getting special treatment. Some waiters would request I bust the tables in their areas because I did more than what was required of me. I would take the customers' drink orders and sometimes even their entrees if the waiters were busy. Now, that isn't to say that I never made a mistake. In fact, one night we were short-staffed and my boss asked me to take the drink orders at a few tables. This one particular table was special to me because there were some local pastors who I recognized, and it was an honor to be able to serve them. They all ordered virgin strawberry daiquiris. There was one slight problem. I forgot to tell the bartender to make them virgin. Well, after a few minutes, I went back to the table to check on them, and they all commented on how great the strawberry daiquiri was and that they would take another virgin daiquiri. I walked back up to the bartender and said, 4 more virgin daiquiris, please. Virgin? The bartender asked. You didn't say virgin the last time. It turned out that I gave all of those pastors a nice shot of rum. I felt terrible. Although they seemed to be feeling excellent, I felt terrible. I never said anything to anybody about it, and I never ever did it again. I learned a lot during my time at the Olive Garden, and just as important, I made a ton of great relationships that will benefit me in the future.
Chapter 12, What an Experience. Today, you are you. That is truer than true. There is no one alive who is youer than you. Dr. Seuss. Dorothy was on to something when she said, "There's no place like home." L. Frank Baum, The Wizard of Oz.
As much as I love my first year in college, I just got to be honest, man. I always felt like a fish out of water. You know, I never had any idea going to college in the first place. I only went to college because Dee Dee went. And the fact that I wasn't familiar with a lot of the cultural habits that existed, I think that bothered me a lot, too. Like, for instance, during chapel service, man, they would all sing these songs, and I'm like, they sang them together, and it was like they remembered them since they were kids. For instance, "By and by, glory, glory, hallelujah," you know, stuff like "The blood that Jesus shed." And I remember this one. This was my favorite. "Precious memories, how they linger." Man, I remember those songs. They went on and on and on. And I'll be real, for the first few months, like, I didn't know the songs, and I didn't want anybody to know that I didn't, so I just lip sync and, you know, pretend like I knew the songs. But you know what really got me? It was those spiritual sayings they used to have, like, "May the Lord watch between me and thee while we're absent one from another." Right? It was like they had their own language. But the biggest challenge of all, it was the cliques. You know, you had kids from Peterson Warren Academy. You had kids from like Pine Forge. You know, I mean, kids from all over the place. It seemed like 90% of them, they all went to high school together, or they were like cousins or something. And you know, it wasn't a whole lot of students at that college from Detroit. It was like a handful of freshmen. And I only knew about one or two, and like, I can't say I really, really knew them. They were Dee Dee friends, and that's how I knew their name. My first year of college reminded me a lot of my basketball experience. I never, ever truly embraced the game of basketball because, in short, I wasn't good at it. I didn't excel. But when it came to football, man, I love football. Why? Because I excelled in it. And when it came to football games on the block, like, people went out of their way to make sure I was on the team. Listen to me. If they played a pickup game of football and I wasn't there, man, they didn't even play. But when it came to basketball, they would go to the park or go to the court, and they wouldn't even tell your boy. That's how bad I was. I was so bad that they only picked me up when they needed an extra dude. You know, like, they only had 4 and they needed 5. And whenever I would get the ball, they'd say, "E, whatever you do, don't dribble, don't shoot, just pass the rock." That's how college was for me. It was a lot like my basketball experience. Why do I say that? You know, it's simple, man. In order to get the full benefits of college, you got to do one or two things at Oakwood. You had to have your academic game tight, or you had to be able to sing, right? Or play an instrument. And unfortunately, I didn't possess any of those skills. I wasn't good academically, I couldn't sing, and I definitely didn't know how to play an instrument. I believe that's why I gravitated toward work more. That's right, my junior year, I left the university and got a job at the Olive Garden. Why? I thrived there. Man, I had a work ethic that was second to none, and it allowed me to become one of the best at what I did. But after working in the real world for a few months, man, as much as I loved it, right? As much as I was affirmed at work, made money at work, and felt like that was my place at work, I knew bussing tables wasn't for me, man. Like, I knew I couldn't bust tables for the rest of my life. And bottom line, some birds, they aren't meant to be caged. And from that time forward, being with Dee Dee, being married, having a need for money, I was in no position, unfortunately, to quit. But from that day forward, I purposed in my heart that I would do what I love doing and not do what I was forced to do to make a living.
Chapter 13, Enter to Learn, Depart to Serve, Oakwood College Mantra. We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Sir Winston Churchill.
My community service efforts had grown drastically, from visiting elementary and middle school students and the elderly to developing and implementing a GED program. I started the GED program because, you know, I felt like I had to do more. It was personal. Like, it was personal because the GED, that was my ticket out of Detroit and my passport to the world. I mean, literally, I felt as if I had a debt to pay to those individuals who helped me. The program specifically targeted mothers who were unable to finish high school due to unplanned pregnancy, and youth offenders, drug dealers, and gang members.
I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Maya Angelou.
When I started the GED program, I didn't have a dime to my name or any financial backing, but it all worked out because there were only a few mandatory items I needed to get started. I had to have a GED book, some pencils and pens, some writing paper, scrap paper, and a classroom with just a few desks. The book, paper, pencil, and pens would be the easy part. Finding office space would be somewhat challenging. And during my devotional time, I prayed to the Lord and I asked for wisdom regarding the class space. A few days later, my answer came to me as I was driving down University Avenue. All of a sudden, it dawned on me that there was a neighborhood community center in the complex. I knew there had to be at least a few classrooms that they weren't using. When I made it home, I called my boy Black to see if he would roll out there with me. You know, go to the center just in case there were a few classrooms available and to find out what the requirements were to lease in the space. As fate would have it, there was plenty of available space. And based on the type of program I was providing the neighborhood, the director was more than happy to accommodate me. And now that the facility was secure, it was time to check off the other items one by one. So I went to the store and I bought my first GED textbook from Books A Million. I then asked one of my professors for writing paper, and the center provided the scrap paper. And to my surprise, they took care of all my printing needs. I had some extra pencils and pens just lying around the house, so I brought those from home. Now, I did classes every day from 12 to 4. I wanted to run the classes earlier, but I knew it might just affect attendance. So I encouraged those that needed extra help to meet me earlier or stay after class. I had a gut feeling that this was not going to be your typical group. It was my guess that some of the students would have some mental and emotional challenges that they would need to overcome before they ever dealt with their academic struggles. And with that in mind, I divided my lesson plan into three segments. Before we did anything, we discussed their goals. You know, the goals for themselves and for my personal class. The next 10 to 15 minutes, I read a powerful motivational devotion and ended it with a powerful speech that summarized the points of the devotion. I figured I had a better chance of gaining their interest and getting them engaged in the learning experience if I made them feel good about themselves and made them believe that somehow their dreams could come true through hard work. Instead of designing my program with a traditional approach, I added some creative methods. Mainly, I use a team approach based on the individual and collective strengths of the students. I assign each of them a day to teach, and I divided my lesson plan with them according to their assigned day. The idea was to keep them as active as possible for the entire class period. I knew it was difficult for a number of them to concentrate on the lesson plan at hand. For some, it was family challenges. You know, family challenges kept them from giving me their undivided attention. And for others, it was the fear that their infants were not in the safest daycare facility. Like, for instance, some mothers would repeatedly dismiss themselves from class to call the daycare just to make sure their child was safe. Had it not been a requirement to pursue their GED in order to remain on government assistance, there is a chance that many of the mothers would not have even enrolled in my program in the first place. Then there were my most challenging students. They were either gangbangers or drug dealers who honestly would have also preferred to be elsewhere, but were required by the courts to get into my GED program or either go to jail. Regardless of the challenge that prevented them from taking school serious, I felt compelled to find out what learning environment and teaching style most complemented their learning style.
Before you speak, it is necessary for you to listen, for God speaks in the silence of the heart. Mother Teresa.
I learned early in my teaching career that you have to possess a unique set of skills if your plans were to teach students from low-income schools. I had absolutely no idea, first of all, that I was going to be a teacher, a counselor, advisor, mentor, bus driver, motivator, and to some, a father figure. Oftentimes, I had to veer from my lesson plan to address the real life issues my students faced. Man, the effort I put forth daily to see to it that my students received a first-class learning experience was exhausting. By the time I straightened up all the chairs, picked up the last piece of paper off the floor, wiped the red ink off the eraser board, and counseled two or three of my students, I was ready to drop dead. I quickly discovered that I had to find a way to replenish myself. There was no way I could put forth that same type of energy day in and day out without refueling. So like a star athlete, I added a pregame warm-up routine to my repertoire. It started with my devotion time in the morning. First, I would pray and ask God for wisdom. As far as I was concerned, God created them, so he had to have a much better sense of what they needed than I did. Two, I spent about 30 minutes envisioning what the class should look like. I actually taught the entire class and my thoughts, so when the actual class took place, it wouldn't be my first time teaching it. Then I put together a strong playlist, and I used my music to help shape my thoughts on the ride over to the community center. I believed that the physical environment played just as much a role in the student's learning process as did the lesson plan and the teacher. I did not have a whole lot to work with, but I plastered images of great African Americans throughout history on the walls in an attempt to inspire my students to reach greatness. My final pregame routine was to look over the lesson plan to make sure no changes were needed. And then I'd walk over to the classroom door so I could greet each student with a smile, a hug, and a specific word of encouragement to help set the tone of the class. As time went on, I began to tap into my network, and I started building a massive library of great motivational books and videos from people like Les Brown, Tony Robbins, and Zig Ziglar. Whenever I finished with the book or the tape, I would just put it in the community center's library so my students could have access to them. While my main goal was keeping my students motivated, I knew the best way to keep them motivated was to motivate myself. So I put together a In Case of a Rainy Day box. Black taught me the importance of forecasting challenges so you can cut them off at the root. The box, it wasn't elaborate or expensive to make. It had real simple stuff in it, like my favorite underdog movie, songs, books, poems, and my goals for the year. And whenever I felt the slightest bit discouraged and I felt like giving up, I would go to my In Case of a Rainy Day box and encourage myself. My philosophy was that your spirit affects your disposition. And if my spirits were negative, how would that affect others? And so I tried to stay enthusiastic about life, and I fought to maintain an upbeat disposition. I figured I wasn't getting paid to teach, so my only reward was their success. And so I wasn't about to waste their time, and I most definitely wasn't about to waste my own time.
Chapter 14, P-U-S-H, Push Until Something Happens. Never underestimate the importance of the beginning. The beginning has the seeds of everything else to come. I started a GED program in the hood, and the rest, was history.
We must accept finite disappointment, but we must never lose infinite hope. Almost an entire year had passed since I dropped everything to pursue my dreams, and absolutely no results. Not one student had registered for the GED test. An entire year of preparation, and I was unable to convince one student that they needed to take the test. Man, I started to believe I had made like a major mistake. Maybe the doubters was right. Maybe I did jump the gun. I should have stayed in school. I kept thinking, man, just maybe I should throw in the towel and give up all my little hoop dreams. You know, go get a real job.
With every deed, you are sowing a seed, though the harvest you may not see. Ella Wheeler Wilcox.
I wasn't sure which was worse. I mean, coming to the grips with the fact that my program was a complete failure, or dealing with the fact that I was succumbing to negative thoughts. I took pride in the fact that I was this jubilant, upbeat person. I was somehow able to rise against every negative circumstance and defy all odds. But this one, man, I was no longer living for myself. I was married. So my decisions, they had a direct impact on D. In fact, 6 months after I left my job to pursue my dreams, all my savings evaporated. And she decided to get a job, you know, to help us make ends meet. I felt so bad because she was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to make her 6 o'clock in the morning clinics, to stay in school until about 3:30. And then she went to work up until about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I decided the best thing to do for the sake of my marriage was to man up and call the GED program quit. Next week will be my last week. And as that week was coming to an end, I put all the students together and I made the big announcement. Guys, this has been one of the most enriching experiences of my life. In almost a year, our relationship has grown. Each of you, each of you have grown academically and personally. And I believe that for each of you, the best is yet to come. And with that being said, I hate to inform you guys that next week is my final week. And no, none of you are the reason for my decision. It's deeper than that. In short, I'm leaving for financial reasons. Over the past year, man, I poured my personal finances into this program. And for real, man, I can no longer live and invest in this program. And as soon as I finish one of my most touching speeches of my career, one of my students, Zanzibar, one of the top drug dealers in the city, blurted out, "Did I just hear you say you were quitting? Tell me you kid." Like, for real, tell me you kid, right? This is a joke. It's got to be a joke. I know Mr. Don't Ever Give Up, Don't Ever Give In is not sitting here telling me that he's about to give up on his dreams because of money. I thought you were different, Mr. Thomas. But you know what? You just like the rest of them fake-ass teachers. You don't give a damn about us. I was devastated. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be stunned or embarrassed. What do you say after one of your students hangs you out to dry in front of the entire class? Like, for real, my ego had been slightly damaged. But you know what? Zanzibar was right. If there was one thing I tried to instill in them, it was that defeat, it wasn't an option. Come hell or high water. Never be denied and never quit short of the prize. And here I was being a hypocrite. I could not come back from that. So I just said, have a great weekend, guys, and I'll see you on Monday. I spent the entire weekend to myself. Man, I call on the Lord every waking hour. Father, look, I'm in a major jam again, and I don't know what to do. You said in your word that you would never leave me nor forsake me, but I have not because I ask not. Well, I'm asking, Father. I can't afford to give up on my students, but God, I also can't afford to keep doing this for free. Please, Lord, please show up and show out. Give me some sort of sign that I'm doing the right thing. And less than a week later, on one of my last days, two older gentlemen just walked through the door of the community center and into the room where I held my GED classes. They just stood there and observed me in action. And after I dismissed the class, the two gentlemen approached me and informed me that they represented the Department of Education for the state of Alabama. They said that for the past few months, they had been hearing good things about the program and that they wanted to see it for themselves. They were so impressed with what they saw that they offered me their support. Needless to say, I accepted the help and continued teaching my class. And from that day forward, they purchased all my computers, software, textbooks, pencils, and took care of all of my printing needs. That one act rekindled my belief in my dreams. And if that wasn't a sign from God, a few weeks later, God showed up again. One evening, Dee Dee and I were scraping our pennies together for groceries, and I felt impressed to pray over the mailbox. And so we stopped, got on our knees, looked out the window, and thanked God for whatever he was getting ready to do. And even though we were down to our last few pennies, I truly felt as if God was about to do something special for us. And after we prayed over that mailbox, the mail lady came 2 hours later. I will never forget going to that mailbox somewhat afraid. I kept thinking to myself, what if it wasn't God? How would that affect Dee Dee's faith in me? And as I got closer to the mailbox, the spirit of anxiety overwhelmed me. Filled with more faith than fear, though, I opened the mailbox, grabbed a handful of mail. The first envelope was junk. The second, junk. And the third was a bill. But there was one more piece of mail that I didn't recognize. So I ripped the edges off the side, and when I opened it, it was a check. It was a check for $285. I literally dropped the check on the floor and fell to the ground. Thank you, Father. Thank you. Not only for the check, but for hearing and answering my prayers. To think that I almost gave up. If it had not been for Zanzibar's words, I would have removed myself from miracle territory and all the blessings that I was about to receive.
Keep on sowing your seed, for you never know which will grow. Perhaps it all will. Albert Einstein.
I didn't think much about farming at the time I departed to serve the community. But I must admit, the time gap between sowing a seed and reaping a harvest seemed awfully slow. However, I learned through the process not to make time to focus. See, the secret to success is in the nature of the seed, not how long it takes to see results. For what you sow, you will eventually reap. Some seeds just take longer to harvest. Shortly after receiving the check and gaining financial support for the program, out of nowhere, the Huntsville Times newspaper start reporting on my program on a regular basis. Soon after, the local television networks start doing stories on my GED program, mainly Channel 48 News. I was on every morning show, and whenever there was an incident involving at-risk youth, I served as like the expert consultant. Channel 48 and David Person even did an hour special on my work in the community. The local support started pouring in left and right. Individual donors start dropping off writing and typing paper, pencils and pens, and all sort of books. The biggest support came by way of a group of professional black men who recently formed a nonprofit organization by the name of the 20 Distinguished Men of Huntsville. Their founder, Lamar Higgins, who at the time was a personal assistant to the mayor, took a deep interest in the work I was doing and offered organizational support. 2 months into my relationship with the organization, they offered me my own private office space, downtown Huntsville, and helped me secure multiple grants. With their help, the news of my contributions to the at-risk population in the city grew rapidly. And as a result, I established credibility among some of the city's leading businessmen and women. Among them were Hall of Famer John Starworth, the former wide receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and a native of Alabama. He graciously absorbed all the costs associated with the GED testing for my students. Another NFL player, Ralph Malone of the Cleveland Browns, and also a native of Alabama, lent me his support. He believed in exposing students to opportunities outside of their neighborhood. He donated funds for field trips to places like the Space and Rocket Center and other engineered base sites. He also secured tables for the students at elaborate galas and award shows in order to expose them to a more affluent way of life. And as a result of all of their support, my students began to thrive. Not only were they the talk of the town, they were now taking the test, and many of them were passing with flying colors and moving on to find great jobs and opportunities in college.
Chapter 15, White Sands and Blue Water. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. The Beach Boys.
Man, things just kept getting better and better and better. That one seed I planted just kept giving and giving and giving. I guess it was about 2 months after the Atlanta experience. I was sitting in my word processor, you know, doing some homework, when all of a sudden I heard a knock at the door. To my surprise, it was a family I met at a revival in Atlanta, the Jameses. They were from Bermuda. They explained that they were visiting their son, my boy Shannon James. We initially made some small talk about, You know how much they enjoyed the work I did in Atlanta. And then all of a sudden, they started asking me about my plans for winter break. They wanted to know if I plan on going home, and if so, how long I was going to stay. You know what I'm saying? Dee Dee and I, we hadn't talked about it, and we surely hadn't figured out what our plans for the winter break were. And then out of nowhere, I mean literally out of nowhere, they pulled out 2 plane tickets and asked if Dee Dee and I were willing to spend a portion of our winter break in Bermuda. I guess they were interested in me doing some of the same work I was doing in Atlanta for their young people in Bermuda. They also wanted me to do a small, like, speaking tour for the public and private school system. I sat there thinking to myself, this can't be real. Bermuda for the winter break? 2 free tickets? Like, this can't be real. And I think what really made it crazy was just 6 months prior to their visit, I specifically dreamt about going to Bermuda. See, my boy Sean Crockwell was from Bermuda. And Sean heard, I guess, 6 months prior to this dream, he heard my car broke down. And so he went out of his way to make sure Dee Dee and I got to school Monday through Friday. So he picked us up, right? And on the way to school, he would talk about what his life was like growing up in Bermuda. Sean talked about his love for football, you know, what we call soccer. As a kid, he talked about the beautiful weather, the beaches, and the food. He didn't realize that while he was sharing all of that about how beautiful his island was, it was a brand new world to me, and I was envisioning everything he was talking about. And one day after a ride with Sean, I thought to myself, man, we're going to go to Bermuda. Yeah, we're going to go to Bermuda. You know, the football, the food, everything. And one day after he dropped me off, I thought to myself, we're going to Bermuda one day. And I'm not just going to dream about it. One day I'm going to experience exactly what Sean was talking about. And who would have known? Who would have known that that small thought would somehow travel across the Atlantic Ocean to the James family in Bermuda and would eventually place them in my living room with not just one, but 2 tickets to Bermuda. The next day, Dee Dee and I were like kids in the candy store. We rushed to Kinko's to get our photos done, and we went to the post office to get our passports. I learned a valuable lesson that year about dreaming. Dreaming alone may not guarantee that all your wishes come true, but it's a hell of a start. And the best part is that dreaming doesn't cost a dime. Bermuda. It was the most beautiful sight I had ever seen in my life.
In preparation for landing, please discontinue the use of all electronic devices. Close your tray tables and fasten your seatbelts. We will be landing in Bermuda shortly,
the flight attendant said.
We will be circling the island, so for our first-time visitors, please take out your cameras.
Seconds later, the plane turned as it made its initial descent. I saw the bluest water I had ever seen in my life. And as the pilot landed the plane, I could see pink, blue, and yellow homes. It was unreal. I spent a little over 2 weeks on the island doing a real small speaking tour for the Bermuda school system. I spent the first half of the day speaking to middle and high school students. I tried to drill in their minds the importance of having a dream, of setting goals, and making the absolute most out of their lives. In the afternoon, I visited at-risk students in youth detention facilities. I was somewhat surprised to see the kids on the island faced with some of the same exact challenges our inner-city youth experienced. Shocked or not, I didn't hold back one bit. My message was simple and straight to the point. Stop the madness. I let them have it, and I challenged them to appreciate the opportunities they had. And I spent the evenings at a church conducting a youth revival. Talk about an upgrade. Man, my self-esteem and my skill set, grew exponentially. My presentations grew stronger and stronger after each school visit. I can't explain the feeling I had walking into that auditorium and seeing students stare into my eyes and listening closely to every word I said. When I got back on that plane and I headed back to the States, I felt like a millionaire. I felt like $1 million. Less than 4 years ago, I was a homeless high school dropout, and now I was becoming a successful international motivational speaker. My thoughts were that if I could reach the youth and impress the teachers and the staff in Bermuda, I should be able to handle my own in the United States as well. Don't be content. When I returned to the States, man, I was hungrier than ever for success. I had a taste of the good life, the beach, the food, the money, and I wasn't about to go back to Huntsville and settle for mediocrity. And as soon as I landed, I got on my grind. I took my GED class to another level. I recruited more volunteers. I purchased more software, and I took my recruitment efforts to a whole nother level. However, there was one slight problem. I was putting so much of my time and effort into my speaking career and my community service work that my grades in school were beginning to suffer. By the end of the fall semester of my junior year, I was dismissed from college. From the outside looking in, it may have appeared that it was a major setback, but in reality, it was a blessing in disguise because neither my head nor my heart was in school. And now that I had been dismissed, I had 24 hours to invest in myself and into my speaking career. And even though I took a lot of flack for getting kicked out, I was determined, I mean absolutely determined, to prove all my doubters that they were absolutely wrong.
Chapter 16. You gotta want it as bad as you want to breathe. The difference between ordinary and extraordinary is that little extra. Jimmy Johnson.
Man, just when I thought I was doing everything I could to position myself for greatness, my boy Marcus Flowers comes out of nowhere and helps your boy realize I wasn't tapping anywhere near my full potential. It was strange. Like, Marcus came up to me and read this excerpt from the book. Like, I don't even remember him showing me the book. All I know is that one story blew my mind and changed my meaning of giving 120% forever. And it was funny. I had just finished speaking to about 300 young people, right? Your boy was feeling himself. Like, you know, I thought I was on my A game. And all of a sudden, Marcus came up to me and was like, E, you gotta read this. Now, let me say this. It was strange seeing Marcus in Huntsville, Alabama. Marcus had graduated about 2 years ago. And when I say entrepreneur, businessman, hustler, like if you looked up in the dictionary, entrepreneur, hustler, businessman, you would see a picture of Marcus Flowers. So it was strange that he was hanging out on campus. But it's crazy. All of a sudden, he started yelling like, E, you got to read this book. Like, no, it's off the chain. Like, no, serious. E, you got to read this book. No, E, like, you got to read this book like yesterday. So I'm like, okay. You know, he had started reading a little bit. And I was like, hold up, Marcus, what's the name of the book? And before I could get the whole question out of my mouth, all I remember Marcus saying was, yo, E, this is Think and Grow Rich. A Black Choice by Dennis Kimbrough. And then he started reading this other story. And he got to the section in the book about this guru and the young man. And the next thing you know, I was captured. Like, I was in it. I couldn't believe it. I had never read anything like it. Like, the story goes a little something like this.
It was a young man who, you know, he wanted to make a lot of money. And so he went to this guru, right? And he told the guru, you know, I want to be on the same level you on. And so the guru said, if you want to be on the same level I'm on, I'll meet you tomorrow at the beach at 4 a.m. He like, the beach? I said, I want to make money. I don't want to swim. Guru said, if you want to make money, I'll meet you tomorrow, 4 a.m. So the young man got there at 4 a.m. He all ready to rock and roll, got on the suit. He should have wore shorts. The old man grabs his hand and said, how bad do you want to be successful? He said, real bad. He said, walk on out in the water. So he walks out into the water. Watch this. When he walks out into the water, it goes waist deep. So he like, this guy crazy. I'm like, I want to make money. He got me out here swimming. I didn't ask to be a lifeguard. I want to make money. He got me in. So he said, come out a little further. Walked out a little further. Then he had it right around this area, the shoulder area. So this old man crazy. He making money, but he crazy. He said, come on out a little further. Came out a little further. It was right at his mouth. My man like, I'm about to go back in here. This guy out of his mind. So the old man said, I thought you said you wanted to be successful. He said, I do. He said, walk a little further. He came, dropped his head in, held him down, hold him down. My man getting scratching. He had him held down. Just before my man was about to pass out, he raised him up. He said, I got a question for you. Somebody answer the question for me. He said, when you were underwater, what did you want to do? He said, I wanted to breathe. He told the guy, he said, when you want to succeed as bad as you want to breathe, then you'll be successful.
Man, all I can say after hearing that story is that my life would never be the same again. After hearing the guru story, I knew my outlook on life was changed forever. I thought I was on my A game until I heard that story, and I realized seconds afterwards that I was not putting forth the type of effort that the guru was talking about. I talked the talk. I watched the videos. I read the books. I even went to the library on a consistent basis, but I just kind of wanted it. I didn't want it as bad as I wanted to breathe. And to be honest with myself, I knew there were several areas that I hadn't been given 120%. And if I wanted to be successful for real, I was going to have to push myself. There were two areas in particular that I tried to ignore. I hoped that if I worked hard enough on my strengths, that it would compensate for and somehow offset my weaknesses. But I knew deep down inside that at some point, I was going to have to man up and deal with my academic struggles and with the pain associated with my biological father not being in my life. In fact, after my son Jalen was born, I felt this overwhelming pressure to stop avoiding both. I knew I could no longer ignore the fact that my academic challenges and my unwillingness to forgive my biological father for not being in my life were somehow keeping me from going to the next level. I knew neither would be easy to confront, but I wanted to succeed as bad as I wanted to breathe. And if that meant tackling my academic struggles, tackling my biological father, the two biggest obstacles in my life, then I was willing to do whatever it took to get to the next level.
Chapter 17, Be Careful What You Wish For. You just might get it.
Man, it's weird how things worked out, but as soon as I put the thought out there, it was like God heard me. And actually, it was like God was waiting on me. The challenge with my father, it happened much sooner than I expected it to. I remember I was in Chicago, speaking to a group of students at a church called Shiloh on the south side of Chicago, 71st in Michigan. A few minutes before I was scheduled to speak, I walked out of the main sanctuary toward the bathroom, and as I exited the sanctuary and entered the lobby, I noticed a male figure that looked just like my biological father. After finding out that the father I had been raised by was not my biological father, I began to ask questions. My Aunt Cleo insinuated that Gerald, whom I assumed was a family friend and used to stop by to see from time to time when I was younger, was actually my biological father. I vaguely recall what he looked like, but this guy standing in the lobby looked just like him. I began thinking to myself, like, nah, that's not possible. For one, how would he even know I was in Chicago? And more specifically, how would he know I was speaking? And the more I stared at him, the more I realized he was my biological father. And as much as I didn't want to admit it at that time, he looked a lot like me. I froze, and my entire disposition changed. My hands start shaking, my heart start racing, and I start feeling sick to my stomach. I was so taken off guard by him showing up that I was contemplating not speaking, man. I felt like just getting out of the place. I was terrified, and I didn't know what to say to him or how to handle the situation. All I wanted to do was run, get out of that church as fast as I could. I was willing to do anything but face him. And so I ran in the bathroom, and I pretended as though I didn't see him. I stayed there as long as I could before I knew I was next on the program. I must have washed my hands and my face at least 20 times, trying to, you know, regain my composure. I finally got the nerve to come out and speak. And I think I was able to pull off something without anybody knowing I was going through, like, a real serious crisis. But as soon as I finished speaking, everything went blank. And the feeling of anxiety, it overtook me all over again. I tried everything in my power to get out of that church and pretend as though I never saw him. But it didn't work. Just as I was leaving the sanctuary, I couldn't help it. I couldn't help but to look in his direction, and as soon as I did, we made eye contact. He was standing directly in the middle of the aisle. I tried to stall as long as I could, so I spoke to everybody on my way out until finally, yep, it was just him and I. Him and I in the lobby, and I had no other choice but to face him. All I could remember after that was being so angry that I wanted to strangle him. Next thing I knew, I opened my mouth, I started shaking, and I asked, why? Why? Why did you abandon me? Why didn't you say anything to me all those years? Why didn't you tell me you were my father? I tried so hard not to let the tears roll down as they swelled up in my eyes and protruded beyond my eyelids. I'm sorry, son, your mother told me not to say anything to you. I wanted to be in your life so bad, but out of respect for your mother's wishes, I just kept silent. His response pissed me off even more. And just weeks ago, I stood in the delivery room, blessed to see the birth of my firstborn son, who I love more than life itself. And I couldn't imagine letting my wife or anything else for that matter keep me from my son, from my baby. I couldn't understand why he didn't fight for me. Why didn't he fight to see me? As a father, it just didn't make sense. It just didn't add up. But in fear that the tears may start rolling if I blinked, I walked off without saying another word. I didn't want him to see me crying. The conversation, though brief, ripped me apart. As much as I tried to deny it for all those years, I still had a desire to know and have a relationship with my father. It was difficult to admit it, because over the years, I had learned how to suppress my feelings and bury my emotions. However, I knew I had to make a conscious effort to let the healing begin. And I knew there was no way I could move on without being man enough to forgive him. I knew. Yeah, I knew it wouldn't be easy, but I made up in my mind on that day, that I was going to open up the lines of communication and give my man a second chance, not only with me, but with his grandson as well. And although I can't explain it with words, once I faced my fears of reconnecting with my father, every struggle I had to confront seemed like a piece of cake. In fact, when the new school year came around, I took it upon myself to take the necessary steps to try and get reinstated. I figured two things. With the birth of my son, Jalen Thomas, and me trying my hardest to make things right with my father, if I could overcome that one challenge, I should be able to get back in school and overcome my academic challenges as well.
Chapter 18. If I could be like Mike, Some people want it to happen. Some wish it would happen. Others make it happen. Michael Jordan.